the difference between people who grew up in an age where if you just scrapped all the battleships, as we did after World War I, they believed if you scrapped all the battleships, you would get rid of war. And so that your generation has grown up to understand things that no other generation in the world has ever known. You've grown up with space in which satellites are an everyday affair so that you hardly notice when another astronaut grows up. In fact, you're a little bored with it. You've grown up with the number of nations in the world doubling in your lifetime. You've grown up in a world where you can see what's happening on the other side of the world as it happens. And you've grown up in a world in which the most potent influence is TV, in which all acts are weighed in terms of how they'll look on TV. And there really isn't much use doing anything that won't show up on TV. So where young radicals in the 1930s used to try to capture a mimeographing machine. That was a great sign of protest in the 1930s. Lemonade and mimeographing machines. But who would look at anything that came out on a mimeographing machine today? So we have sit-ins, bleed-ins, sleep-ins, love-ins. Doesn't make any difference what. If you do it with your body, it will get on TV. But just words, and especially words on paper, don't get on TV. Now, this is the world that you live in. And one of the things that anthropology can hopefully contribute is that anthropologists are specialists in learning other people's languages. And I go and live in a savage community who speak a language that no one's ever written down, and they don't know they have a grammar. And I have to sit down and make them talk until I can work out the language and figure it out and write it down and make a grammar and learn to speak it. Now, this is what we have to do today. My generation has to learn your language. And I don't mean just words, you know, you've only got about 30 extra ones, and that's not much work, because I'm used to learning 200 words a day of a strange language. And the current college slang doesn't run to a whole lot. But we also have the problem, and here I have to act as one of my informants in the savage tribe would act, that you've got to learn our language. Because you need to know what our language and what's in our heads and what we see when we look into the sky and what kind of a world we grew up with, just as much as we need to learn yours. And in many ways, that's a lot harder, because we've lived a lot longer and read a lot more books and got a lot of new ideas in our head. I was having an argument with a very young man. I think he was very young. It's over the telephone, so I could only judge from his ideas. He wanted to name a book about a New Guinea tribe, Gardens of War. I said, I think that's a very bad title, because things that have gardens in them are full of roses and houris, and most of the books that used to be talked to, Gardens of Allah, you know, and you had a lot of Muslim houris that you were going to get when you went to a Muslim heaven. And I don't think this describes this New Guinea tribe very well, because they're, to begin with, they're extremely unattractive women, and they have a lot of their fingers cut off. Every time a relative is killed, they chopped a joint off. And the kind of war they had doesn't fit this kind of garden image. Well, he said he couldn't understand what I was talking about, and he was too young to understand it. And I pointed out, there are a lot of people who are over 40, and they're the ones that buy lots of books still. So you better think about a title that doesn't echo in everybody's heads with something that you don't even know exists. You're going to be living for, and your average expectation of life is now, I think, up to 77 years. That's an average, therefore, of 57 years per student here. If you add that up, that's a lot of years. you're going to be parents, grandparents, and great-grandparents. And by that time, the golden ghettos are going to have a different shape. And for quite a lot of that, you're going to have to put up with people who speak a different language and who have different things in their heads. And one of the most valuable things you can do while you're in college is to learn how their heads work, so that when you have to go out and start jobs, and your bosses and your supervisors and your parents-in-law and your grandparents-in-law, all of which you'll have around, belong in a sense to another tribe. They've got another set of ideas, they talk another language, and if you're going to communicate with them and if they're going to communicate with you, you've got to learn their language and they've got to learn yours. There's one right there. Now, I'm going to try to repeat the questions because I think they're taping this for future generations. And if I don't repeat your question right, will you tell me what is the main idea that you can gain from your parents' generation? Well, I think that your parents' generation believed, your parents' generation were, most of them were influenced by the Depression. Although they weren't old enough to experience it very much, but their parents experienced it very vividly. And I think that there's a tendency for your parents' generation to say that security is the most important thing. That the important thing for you to do is to get the kind of training for the kind of job that will give you security. I think this is still very important to your parents. Whereas you belong to a generation who's fascinated by what can be done in urban areas or overseas. The generations had the Peace Corps and VISTA and a tremendous interest in experimentation with new things. And your parents, on the whole, grew up in a non-experimental and in many ways a rather deprived era. And so they value security, and probably the most valuable thing they've given is they've taught you that there's steps on a ladder. And you better be careful, you know, that you deal with the last rung so that if you want to go further or want to go somewhere else, you will have the necessary prerequisites. I think probably your parents are more impressed with prerequisites, as they called in the catalog, than almost anything else. Would you stand up, please?
You made the point, I think it's disturbing, that members of our generation are refusing to live in the bond. There's more of us coming out with this idea of what we should see in the future.
I made the point certain numbers of your generation are refusing to live with the bond? No. I didn't. You see, the people that were refusing to live with the bomb were your parents' generation that didn't understand it. You're not refusing to live with the bomb. No, but how are you? Come on, tell me. How are you refusing to live with the bomb? I mean, there isn't any way of refusing to live with the bomb except commit suicide this minute. I mean, because the bomb happens to be here. You see, the bomb is reality. We can stop stockpiling bombs, and we should, you know, because they're dangerous to have around. They're very dangerous to have around. And some idiot or a maniac or somebody who isn't careful what they're dropping out of the tail of a plane might drop one. And so that we should, and we can refuse to back up stockpiling, as we can fight and fight against stockpiling. But the thing that you cannot get rid of is the knowledge of how to make the bomb. You see, there is no way in the world to get rid of that, except to kill everybody on Earth. And I don't know what good that would do. That's what I mean by living with the bomb. I don't mean endorsing using the bomb. I mean realizing that we have a responsibility that we never had before, which is the responsibility to see that the bomb is never used. Now that's what I would, so that I don't call that refusing to live with the bomb, I I call it living with a bomb, to recognize just how dangerous the bomb is and how terribly responsible not only this generation, but every generation that we can foresee for a very long time will have to live with. Now, does that contradict what you're saying, or did you misunderstand what I said, or did I misunderstand what you said? Many people feel that your generation is apathetic. And do I think that you're more apathetic than an earlier generation? And is this the cause for renewed interest in religion? Is that right? Well, I didn't know anybody thought your generation was apathetic. I mean, they're mostly moaning because you aren't. Now, of course, the activists in your own college think you're apathetic. Obviously, of course. The vanguard always thinks everybody else is apathetic. And it's very hard for the young radicals to realize that if they want to be in the vanguard, everybody else is going to be behind them. And that's something that's awfully hard to understand. So the bulk of college students are always apathetic from the point of view of the leaders, you know, who want them to object to this or demonstrate for that or march there or have a fit about something. And there are all those students who won't do anything. They were in college with me, too. They all read Ethel M. Dell or something. And you know, and didn't have the right fire about something or other, because from the standpoint of the people who had fire. But in general, this is not an apathetic generation. If anybody ever saw the 50s, this is a live wire generation interested in all sorts of things. Now, I think there's a difference between this kind of college, where most of you have to do some work, most of you have to use your time when you're not studying, working, or commuting, a good proportion of you, and when you don't have the spare time to spend a whole summer in volunteer activities. Therefore, there's probably, in some ways, less public activity than there can be in colleges where students aren't busy, though in almost every college today, students are working pretty hard, too, and they have a limited amount of time to give freely to all sorts of community activities. But if it's so, as I was competently informed, that you've got one of the best tutoring programs in the state, it means that you find time to do it, even so. I wouldn't characterize this generation as apathetic at all. Will the speed of rapid change, how will it affect our society, and will it affect individual psychological makeup? Well, if you absorb the idea that there is going to be change and change and change, that you're not going to be mature in the world you were born in, and you're going to die in a world that you never even dreamed of, if you can get that into your bones, this will be a new kind of person. You see, someone who is brought up to change, brought up to nest in the gale, to expect the world to be different, not to to know that you don't know where you'll be living 25 years from now. You don't know on what continent. You don't know what you'll be doing or what your husbands will be doing. You don't know what your children will look like, except roughly, but only very roughly. You don't know what language you may be speaking. You don't know what you'll be eating. You don't know what organs you may have borrowed from other people by that time, or given them. You know, kidney here, eye there, so that our notions of the continuity of the body will be quite different. Now, if you get that into your bones now, you're going to be a different kind of person than most of the people alive today who had the in this country, who had an idea that they were, you know, they bought their cemetery lots. If you really look about things like cemetery lots, you get a good idea of what your psychological position is. Now, in Russia, 80 years ago, a young girl would go into a great house, a young peasant girl, as a nurse for the first baby. And she took with her, in her trunk, the dress that she was going to be buried in. Now, that was an unchanging society. Now, many of your grandparents have bought a cemetery lot. They bought it when their parents died and they left room for themselves and their children. You know, if you stop and consider whether you think it would be a good investment right now to buy a cemetery lot, you'll get a little bit of a notion of a changed point of view. Some of you may be buried on an artificial satellite planet somewhere in outer space, for all you know, and I think, you know, a cemetery lot wouldn't be an awfully good investment. This is a question from a well-identified member of the older generation, self-identified. How do you bring children up, and what do you pass on to your children? I don't think that's so hard. You pass on to your children a much more generalized education than we used to do. So you don't teach children specifics except as transitory. Now, I remember I was taught when I was a child that when you went to somebody's house, you knocked or rang the bell 3 times. If nobody answered, you went away. Well, today you teach children to climb in the windows and do all sorts of things. But you still could teach them that they're certain that we have manners, but manners change. That what you learn to do when you go into a house is sort of look around, figure out what the style is, and keep your shoes on if the people keep their shoes on, take them off if they take them off, and don't walk around rigidly with one foot shoe on and one shoe off or something, but try to relate to what's happening. I think we have to teach much more generalized things to children, as we teach them about courtesy but not about specific manners. We teach them the principal courtesies to find out what other people are doing. We don't teach them you have to obey your mother, and no matter what crazy thing she says, you know, which was the way we used to be brought up, you know, do this. Why? Because I'm your mother. Now, this doesn't go down today. You know, it's not a good argument. Instead, you say, now you jolly well do what Aunt Susie says, if you're going to spend the afternoon there. Why do I have to obey Aunt Susie? Because Aunt Susie's in charge. And Aunt Susie's going to get into trouble if something happens to you. Now, if you don't like it, you can stay home. But not because she's your aunt. See, aunts have no standing. But, and in return, parents have to, you see, I think you can demand absolute obedience from children. If you demand it in terms of the fact I'm the person in charge, and in terms of being the person in charge, if I say, sit down, I'm only going to say it because something's coming and it's going to take your head off in a minute. And not because I'm tired of your wiggling. Now, I have a story that I am not going to tell you who it's about because you know the name too well, but a prominent youth leader who is getting rather beyond youth, as youth leaders tend to be. When he was a little boy, he was brought up with a very permissive modern mother. One day she'd had enough. He was rampaging around the living room. She said, go to your room. And he stopped and he stared. He'd never heard anything like that before. He said, you, why? She said, because I say so. He said, you mean I have to go to my room because you say so? She said, yes. All right, Mother, but remember what happened to the Light Brigade. Now, that was 30 years ago when we began bringing children up permissively. But I think you can demand obedience, but you demand it in terms of who's responsible, not in terms of status. And you demand that parents do not make arbitrary demands on children. They don't keep on saying, stop wiggling. You know, if you listen to the average old-fashioned parent, they dish out 40 commands that don't matter for one that does. And then we went through a period that, as a result, the children didn't listen to any of them. Now, I think we can go on to another step. Now, I don't think it's difficult. You bring up a child to expect new situations and to have sufficient sophistication and responsibility to be able to act in a new situation. Girl of your generation. Since our generation's ideas are different from our parents, is it right for our parents to condemn ideas of our generation, such as a young man not wanting to fight in the Vietnam War? Well, in this country, the last generation has always been condemning the ideas of the next generation, steadily, without stopping. You go back and interview your parents about what their parents thought If you've got some grandparents around, interview them. Find out who first cut their hair in your family. You know, this was in the early 1920s, and when I cut my hair, the barber shop wept. And it was, oh, such a sacrilege. And we didn't make quite the fuss we make about boys, but we made plenty. And this is a terrible thing to do. You go back and interview your parents. Find out, and it just depends on how many generations they are in this country, how many big rows they've had. Now, you'll find that they will now justify the fact that their parents condemned them, probably. You have to expect that the generation in power and with the responsibility are going to object to those who they're supporting, what they do if they do something they don't like. And in this country, the man who pays the piper calls the tune. If you don't like it, you go pay the piper yourself. But parents, as long as they're supporting their children and are responsible for them, can be held up by the law, can be held up by neighbors, can be made to be deeply, deeply ashamed of what their children are doing. If their children insist on staying home and being supported, then I think it's reasonable enough to expect they're going to have very uncomfortable ideas. I mean, most parents, from the standpoint of most children, have had uncomfortable ideas right through American history. It is not new. And people objected to every war we've ever had. Only a great many more people were killed in riots at the time of the Civil War. And a great many more people were put in jail for dissent. I mean, we're doing nothing today compared to what we did in World War I or even in World War II. This is the most lenient period with the largest numbers of demonstrations and the smallest numbers in jail that we've ever had in the United States. But parents are going to be inconvenient, but they're also terribly convenient. You know, they provide you with a house. It costs a lot to get. And a car, or half a car, or a third of a car, and mother's iron clothes, and men's clothes, and pay dentist bills. We saw recently a very nice case where a Roman Catholic girl was marrying a Jewish boy, and both families were mad. And they were not, neither family was going to help a bit. So they came home from college to see, each to see what they could collect before they got married. And you'd be surprised what they managed to amass individually before they went off and got married. They got their teeth fixed, extra things they needed for this and for that, and perfect supplies of all sorts of technical equipment. Very well-off parents they were. And they weren't going to give those two kids anything if they got married. They were pretty well-equipped by the time they got married, and it demonstrated how useful parents are. But it's not surprising that they disagreed. Now, my mother was an agnostic, and I wanted to go to church, which she violently disapproved of. And she also terribly disapproved. She thought children caught contagious diseases in Sunday school. Not in school, but in Sunday school. She was very prejudiced about religion. And I had a terrible time being allowed to go to Sunday school because she knew I'd catch something. I prayed for her.